Is the U.S. ready to put conditions on military aid to Israel?
There's really no credibility when the Biden administration refuses to use the leverage that it does have. And the most significant source of leverage that the United States has is the massive amount of arms provided to Israel.
Plus, NATO turns 75 and is still growing.
Ukraine will become a member of NATO. Our purpose at the summit is to help build a bridge to that membership.
And later, an update from Kyiv, violence in Myanmar, and the new political scene in Turkey. Today is Thursday, April 4th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Rescuers are still searching for missing people and working to reach hundreds who became stranded following Wednesday's earthquake in Taiwan. Dozens of quarry workers who were trapped have been rescued. However, since our last broadcast, the death toll has risen to 10, with more than 1,000 injured. And a developing story now from the Horn of Africa, Somalia has expelled Ethiopia's ambassador and accuses Addis Ababa of interference. U.S. President Joe Biden is facing growing calls to turn outrage over the deaths of seven aid workers with World Central Kitchen into new conditions placed on military support for Israel. This as he's prepared to confront Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the incident on Thursday. It'll be his first call with Netanyahu since the Israeli strike, and Biden is expected to express anger and urge Israel to do more to protect humanitarian staff and civilians. Jose Andres is the founder of World Central Kitchen. He spoke with Israeli TV channel Keshet 12.
Everybody understands that food is a universal right, that food is not a weapon of war. Food should never be a weapon. And the airstrikes on our convoy, I don't think were an unfortunate mistake. It was really a direct attack on a clearly marked vehicles.
Meanwhile, in a statement issued Thursday, World Central Kitchen has asked for an independent investigation of the incident. Israel said on Thursday that an investigation is underway. Rakela Karamson is an Israeli government spokesperson.
Initial investigation results have already been shared by the chief of staff, and they indicate that it was a mistake that followed a misidentification at night in very complex war conditions. But we are conducting a thorough and transparent examination of this case through the fact-finding assessment mechanism, an independent expert body. In the coming weeks, as the findings become clear, we will be transparent and share the results with the public.
She said Israel would make adjustments.
So clearly something went wrong here. And as we learn more and the investigation reveals exactly what happened and the cause of what happened, we will certainly adjust our practices in the future to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
The incident has added to an increase in tension between the U.S. and Israel. Many analysts and activists are suggesting that one way the U.S. can pressure Israel to change its tactics is by limiting weapon sales or making them conditional. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara reports.
A ship operated by aid group World Central Kitchen left Gaza and returned to Cyprus Wednesday, its food aid undelivered after Israeli airstrikes killed seven of the charity group's workers, increasing demands that the Biden administration restrict its military aid to Israel. The White House shows no signs of doing so.
We are still supporting their right to defend themselves, and we're going to continue to do that. We're also going to see what the results of the investigation is. I'm not going to get ahead of decisions that haven't been made yet.
Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. aid, most of it in military assistance. Under U.S. law, the administration must notify Congress of weapons transfer to Israel that's larger than $25 million. Since the October 7th Hamas attack, Congress has been notified of four, said Josh Paul, former director at the State Department agency that handles weapons transfers.
Two of those were under the foreign military sales system, and both of those the Biden administration used an emergency authority to set aside the regular statutory congressional notification period. Two of them have been via the direct commercial sales process and have been notified to Congress, but with less visibility because there is less information that is provided to the public on direct commercial sales.
In addition, a Department of Defense official who spoke to VOA under a condition of anonymity confirmed reporting by the Washington Post that since October 7th, over 100 arms transfers to Israel have taken place without informing Congress because the packages were structured to fall below the notification threshold.
When they are publicly saying that Israel needs to take more steps to protect civilians, but privately pushing through hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons, there's really no credibility when the Biden administration refuses to use the leverage that it does have. And the most significant source of leverage that the United States has is the massive amount of arms provided to Israel.
Since Harry Truman recognized Israel minutes after its founding in 1948, American presidents have supported the country almost all unconditionally, except President George H.W. Bush, who in 1991 gave Israel an ultimatum to freeze settlements on Palestinian land in exchange for $10 billion in loan guarantees. That approach worked, but not all agree that restricting aid will affect change.
It's just been a sort of inexact tool for the U.S. in the past. And so I think that's internalized within this administration right now. And so I think that's that coupled with the president's longstanding commitment to Israel is why you haven't seen any real steps taken on this front.
President Joe Biden said in a statement he is outraged and heartbroken by the deaths of World Central Kitchen workers, his latest stern rebuke over Israel's war conduct. Still, he refuses to respond to the question many are asking.
Would you consider conditioning military aid?
Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Brussels for the 75th anniversary of NATO. He met with other NATO foreign ministers to celebrate the anniversary on Thursday, as he suggested the alliance would grow.
Ukraine will become a member of NATO. Our purpose at the summit is to help build a bridge to that membership to create a clear pathway for Ukraine moving forward.
The war in Ukraine remains a high priority as the alliance's 32 member states agreed to take some of the coordination responsibility away from the United States in what might be a hedge against a possible Trump victory in the upcoming presidential election. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba continues his visit to the NATO headquarters in Brussels. Meanwhile, Russian forces have launched a massive drone attack against Kharkiv. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
On Thursday, Dmytro Kuleba, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine, continues his two-day visit to the NATO headquarters. Kuleba welcomed the plans to support Ukraine, but pointed out that this plan should involve the allocation of new funds and not the redistribution of previous commitments. Kuleba said,
I didn't want to spoil the birthday party for NATO, but I felt compelled to deliver a very sobering message on behalf of Ukrainians about the state of Russian air attacks on my country, destroying our energy system, our economy, killing civilians. And I urged allies today to provide Ukraine with new additional air defense systems.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg previously said that the allies should support Ukraine in the long term amid discussions on creating a 100 billion euro fund for Ukraine. Also, according to Politico, the US and other Western countries are considering bringing the Ukraine Defense Contact Group in Ramstein under NATO auspices, one of several new proposals that could help keep arms flowing to Kyiv amid political changes in the US or Europe. Meanwhile, the fighting in Ukraine continues. In the early hours of April 4th, Ukrainian air defense destroyed 11 of 20 drones launched by Russian forces at the Kharkiv region. As a result of the attack, three rescue workers and a civilian were killed and 12 more people were injured. Residential and private buildings were damaged. The Ukrainian Rescue Service reported that Russian forces hit one of the locations two times, the second attack causing the death of three rescue workers who were responding to the first attack. Also, Russian forces continue to conduct constant shelling of the Kharkiv region, forcing locals to leave their homes. The situation there is getting worse, particularly near the Russia-Ukraine border. Oleksandr Humenyuk is a Ukrainian volunteer evacuating local residents from that area.
Сьогодні ми їдемо евакуювати людей у селище Бочкове. Це за Вовчанськом.
Today we're going to evacuate people from Bochkove. It's behind Vovchansk, around 2 kilometers to the border. People's houses were hit yesterday or the day before yesterday and were damaged. They have nowhere to live. And one shouldn't live there. They need to leave.
Дуже часто обстрілюються, тому довго знаходитись там не треба.
Meanwhile, President Zelensky, in his evening address on April 3rd, commenting on Russia's plans to mobilize an additional 300,000 military personnel, stated that Ukraine clearly understands Russia's goal.
Поступово плануємо і нашу роботу.
We are gradually planning our work with our partners for the coming months. Both May and June should be a time of activity for the sake of Ukraine, for the sake of achieving our goals in this war. We clearly understand what Russia is preparing for, what they want, and that they will be drafting soldiers into their army. And we, all of us, our partners, must have a strong response to Russian operations, any Russian operations. We must win this war. This is Ukraine's historic chance to thwart Russian revanchism, and we must seize it.
Перемогти у цій війні – це історичний шанс України зламати російський реваншизм. І ми маємо цим шансом скористатися.
Earlier, Zelensky commented on how many recruits will be mobilized into the Ukrainian army this year, saying that we don't need 500,000, a number that was announced previously. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Political violence in Myanmar. That story in just a moment, but first, back to Ukraine. From the start of the war, drones have played an important role in carrying out surveillance missions and long-range attacks. Since last year, a new type of drone has come into the picture and is changing how war is waged on the front lines. They're called first-person view drones, and as Ian Boyshat reports from Donbass, they've become a nightmare for soldiers on both sides of the battlefield.
Ukrainian combat medics training to be even faster and evacuate more quickly. It's even more critical now that both sides of the war between Ukraine and Russia are using first-person view drones on the front lines. The drones are small, cheap, and deadly.
The enemy has adopted a new method starting approximately 6 months ago, if not earlier.
Here in South Donbass, Ukrainian soldiers are training to increase their speed, knowing that a first-person view, or FPV, may be racing after them and ready to strike. Now, more than ever, they realize that their next deployment to the front lines could be their last.
One of the biggest challenges during evacuation is the presence of FPV drones. This often leads to delays of up to 12 hours or more. Every delay risks lives.
FPV drones are mounted with cameras that stream back live images to drone pilots who can see those pictures through virtual reality headsets or goggles and control the drones using tablets. Soldiers load an explosive onto the drone, which then slams into its target, all while sending back a first-person view of the impact and explosion. They are disposable. Ukrainian officials told VOA they cost just about $300 apiece. They are light and fly close to the ground, under the radar, and hard to detect, unlike their conventional predecessors, which are easy to spot and easy prey for anti-aircraft guns. Their low cost and effectiveness mean that since mid-2023, the drones have appeared in swarms. They hit harder and deeper. This is also thanks to more advanced retransmitter or remote control units that enable them to go farther into enemy territory.
Different retransmitters have emerged, significantly increasing the range for the same FPV drones. Consequently, the destruction of equipment has escalated significantly.
Lights are kept dim in this room deep in a forest in northern Donbass, where Chief commands his fleet of drones. One operator maneuvers close to a Russian armored vehicle, then crashes the drone into it. The monitor fades to black. Meanwhile, another drone surveys from a distance, checking for signs of smoke to confirm the drone's impact. Next door, in the kitchen, 3D printers are busy producing plastic parts to be assembled with electric motors sourced from China. Dozens of these drones are dispatched to the front lines daily and inflicting huge damage. The FPV drones may appear like toys, but they carry bombs capable of inflicting devastating damage on both personnel and equipment. Irina is an IT engineer and volunteer drone pilot with one of the highest number of hits in this unit.
Maybe weird because there are people there, but you know, when we're destroying them, we are protecting us.
Irina says she loves drones, but hopes the war ends soon and that she doesn't have to use them as a weapon anymore. Yabwisha, VOA News, Donbass, Ukraine.
And in other drone attack news, opponents of army rule in Myanmar said on Thursday they carried out drone attacks on two military targets in its capital, Naypyidaw, attacks which, if confirmed, would be a major blow to the image of a military junta struggling to govern. For more, I'm joined by Injin Yang of VOA's Burmese service. Injin, we know that the NUG, the National Unity Government, a shadow government or opposition group to the military junta in Myanmar, is claiming that they've launched two drone attacks against the military government there. What do we know?
We are also closely monitoring the situation. But we don't know the damage or the casualties. Of the result of this attack yet. We are still trying to reach out to the witnesses, but they just confirmed that the attack. So the NUG government, which it calls itself the shadow government in Myanmar, carried out a very significant drone attack on a strategic location in the capital of Naypyidaw, which is built by the military. So according to the statement by the NUG, it deployed 29 drones armed with explosives to target key sites, including the Air Force Base and Army headquarters. So according to our report from the ground, they confirmed that the attack in those locations.
Now, this isn't common in the larger cities in Myanmar, is it?
No, not at all. This is the first time a very significant attack. And even I think it is nobody expectation that kind of attack. I mean, sophisticated. It's very rare and very significant.
Now, the NUG has been in opposition to the military government for a long time, but as we've said, the violence, especially in the large cities, has been uncommon. Have they said there will be more? Do you expect more violence?
According to their statement, they will implement more attacks in near future.
Injin Yang is a reporter with VOA's Burmese service. Injin, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
And now a look at the Turkish political landscape following this past weekend's elections. Reuters' Sekir Jazni starts us off.
Thousands celebrated in the streets of the Turkish city of Van on Wednesday after the city's election board restored a pro-Kurdish mayor-elect, Abdullah Zidan. He was blocked from office by Turkish authorities, despite winning local elections on Sunday. Instead, they announced that the runner-up from President Tayyip Erdogan's AK party, who garnered 27% of the vote, would assume the seat, despite Zidane's 55% majority. The decision sparked protests across Van, with demonstrators clashing with police on Wednesday. Speaking at an iftar event in Ankara, President Erdogan accused the protesters of trying to terrorize the streets, and said Turkey would not allow terrorism barons to disturb the peace in cities. The ruling was later overturned by the High Election Board after Zidane's appeal, prompting larger crowds to flood the streets once again in celebration. People waved flags of Zidane's DiEM party, made victory signs, and danced as Zidane told the crowd that the people had protected their honor.
That's Sekar Jasny of Reuters reporting for us today. And finally, Turkey's nationwide local elections this week dealt President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's ruling AK party its worst electoral defeat, signaling what analysts say is a momentous change in Turkey's political direction. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkey's main opposition, CHP party, sweeping gains in nationwide local elections are a significant reversal in the party's fortunes, analysts say, considering President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's re-election last year. Can Selçuk'i is the head of Istanbul's economic research, a polling firm.
After the loss of the May elections for the opposition, everybody's thought that, you know, the opposition was in a state of despair, but that doesn't seem to be the case, and it's a really turning point, I think, for Turkish political landscape.
Erdogan put himself at the forefront, leading the campaign to retake Istanbul from incumbent mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu. But İmamoğlu extended his control of the city, capturing strongholds of Erdogan's AK party, including the Beyoğlu district, where Erdogan grew up and had a personal power base. Near 70% inflation and 50% interest rates, analysts say, were key factors in AK party's defeat. Analysts say İmamoğlu has portrayed his leadership as inclusive, and analysts say that has been a factor in his success, burnishing his credentials as a potential presidential challenger. Ankara's mayor, Mansur Yavaş of the CHP, also secured a landslide victory. Analysts say the two mayors have managed to win over religious voters, extending their party's reach beyond its staunchly secular base. Experts say this opens the door to success for them in parts of Turkey that have been Erdogan's strongholds, such as Anatolia. İşdok Gözaydın is a specialist on Turkish religion and state relations at Istanbul's İstinye University.
These are places that are considered to be religiously conservative, or at least conservative, and CHP has never been successful in those places before. And that's also valid for Central Anatolia. Central Anatolia is usually much more nationalist, much more religiously sensitive, but that for the first time, they've been successful.
The March 31st local elections have changed Turkey's electoral map, with the CHP controlling many provincial cities for the first time in a generation. Analysts say that, with local mayors having considerable power to shape daily life, the opposition has a major opportunity. Can Selçuk'i of Istanbul Economic Research.
CHP has been granted a chance to show how they govern for the next 5 years. So I think it's a huge opportunity for the main opposition to showcase their governing skills in parts of the country where they could never win elections.
Analysts say the performance of CHP in these mayoral elections could determine the outcome of the 2028 presidential elections. At a time when Erdogan's party is struggling to tame rampant inflation, they say that prospect appears to be real. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.